whether I learned about it, whether I had foreknowledge of this. We certainly had foreknowledge that the Iranians were going to land there. What I'm a little uncertain about is whether I personally had foreknowledge that it was all going to be stage managed. I'm not sure whether I heard that before or after, but it was.
What was the U.S., the official U.S. reaction to this move on the Shah's part?
Excuse me. Well, there had, mind you, this had been preceded by claims that these islands belong to Iran for some period of time. And the reason that Iran had not acted on what it felt was its sovereign right in the past, in part was due to its unwillingness or its inability to confront the British over this. But the time had long since passed where they were going to pursue the matter and further delay assuming their sovereign rights any further. That the U.S. had a reaction, I don't really remember. I'm sure that, you know, the noonday press conference guy must have been asked a question, he must have provided some kind of an answer, probably along the line, well, it's, you know, these are Iranian, it's Iranian territory.
I think I read in the Jerry Six book that at some point in the 70s, the U.S. requested the Shah to provide weapons to Somalia for use against Ethiopia. Was this under Nixon?
Somalia?
Yeah. To be used against Ethiopia. Six suggests that in his book at one point. But he doesn't say what years it occurred.
Well, again, I can't remember precisely either. Yes, well, we were asking the Shah, as time went on, to do a lot of things, and he generally did, at least where he felt that there was, you know, a mutual interest, and he wasn't our lackey, sort of, going out and doing
right.
things. But, mind you, I don't know if Kissinger's said this in his book or not, but the Shah and the President, and of course Kissinger, saw things pretty much the same way and thought about international forces and events pretty much the same way. So that when we had occasion to discuss specifics, for example, the Ethiopian situation. There was an identity of views that here are the Russian presence in the Horn of Africa. This is a potentially threatening thing to Iran's interests, to our interests, and then you got on to the question, what does one do about it, or what can one do about it? And we could well have gotten to the particulars of the Somalis could use some military and or financial assistance. We'd help out, I'm pretty sure. We had requested him to help out in sub-Sahara affairs from time to time. Modest, not military equipment, I remember, but financial assistance, and he was forthcoming. He was forthcoming so far as Egypt is concerned. Again, you know, it was mutual interest.
When you were country director during the early 70s, how often did you visit Iran? Were there periodic visits? You mentioned the one visit with Irwin.
I guess I managed to get there, oh, not every year, but maybe 18 months. In other words, about two or three visits during the time that I was country director.
You feel like routine consultations with the embassy?
Yes. And then, of course, you have the ambassador come to Washington. You have the state visits. So there was quite a back and forth.
What were your impressions of the political and economic situation in the country as a whole, say, compared when you were there in the early 60s? How have things changed?
Well, when you asked me about my impressions of the Shah and that period, I would say that this was, in broad general terms, also my impressions of the country. In other words, a much more confident, more dynamic, if you will. A lot of things were happening. There were people that argued too much too fast, but a dynamic, forward-moving situation. The political scene quiescent in terms of, we want to talk about politics, you know, are there active opposition and the great ferment and all that? No. I think the country was sort of preoccupied. So much going on in the economic side, and economic development, this explosion of the middle class, people traveling abroad, people coming to the country, and so forth. So that it was an infectious, you might say, atmosphere.
So the concerns of the late 50s about political instability had pretty much had disappeared largely by this period?
By and large, on the part of most observers. Now there were continuing critics. People didn't like the Shah for one reason or another, and people who felt that, you know, this was all just a Potemkin village exercise and it was all going to collapse. One heard that, but it was far, far from the majority view. Whether you were, and I'm not talking about just Americans, but I'm just any outsider, and most of your audience for that matter.
Did you yourself get a sense, or what kind of a sense did you get, of the depth of popular support for the Shah in the country?
Well, Shah was never a, quote, popular figure. Respected, I mean, he was Shah. I suppose there was an element of fear. Not overt. Paralyzing sense or anything like that, but you know, but he was the boss. He was quite strict. I would put it this way: I don't think that you encountered. I didn't, and I don't know if really or very many people did. Anybody of consequence who really doubted who was in charge. It was generally agreed that Shah was firmly in control. Now, as I say, there were these criticisms from time to time that one heard about, well, this is bound to fall apart one of these days, but not that it was about to happen tomorrow kind of thing, as you did here in an earlier period.
Well,
I mean, all of the reins of power were in his hands. I mean, the military, the internal security, all of the major economic institutions, was all there. Nobody else had it. So there basically wasn't really any argument about it.
Now, during these years, religious opponents of the Shah, like Ayatollah Khomeini, were active in their opposition at home or overseas. Overseas by this point.
Yeah, and he was in exile.
Yeah. Yeah. Did State Department officials monitor his activity or his influence? Any special attention paid to him or the religious opposition?
Little to none that I know of. The first place, and I know that there's been comment about, you know, we should have been involved much more deeply with the religious opposition. Well, it's ludicrous to suggest that in any objective way. That an outsider, non-Iranian, is going to be able to penetrate the inner circles of a closed society, which it was, particularly a religious closed society, and debate the issues of the day, or even discuss the issues of the day with these people. I mean, it's just absurd. And this applies not just to Americans, but to any outsider. And that certainly includes Soviets. You are a Ferengi, a foreigner. And it was hard enough to get into just the Iranian society per se. As I mentioned, I was very fortunate because of the contacts that I've made in the earlier period. But the business of confidence building and developing a mutual respect and trust is not an easy thing. And it doesn't come easy to the Iranians because of their history and cultural heritage and all the rest of it. But as I say, to go beyond that and suggest that it would have been even possible to have somehow or another gotten close to these people is ridiculous. Even the Iranian Western educated elite. I mean, there was an alliance of convenience at one point, at a critical point, but preceding and subsequent to that, no. You don't find any Western educated Iranians playing a particularly significant or important role in the Khomeini regime today.
Now, you mentioned earlier, I think in the day that during the late 50s, early 60s, there were some contacts with opposition figures between the embassy, by the embassy. Would this continue into the 70s, or was it dropped?
Well, you
much?
Would see, I mean, you know, you'd see old National Fronters on a social occasion here and there. You'd see some of the old tribal Hans here and there. Some of them, indeed, quite a number of the younger ones, had been co-opted into the system. And so they were there, the Minister of Health, as I recall, had been a former opposition leader. There were numbers in fairly senior positions spotted around the government. And the Shah said to them, I don't know the exact conversation, obviously I wasn't present, but I know that in general, in effect, he said, well, if you think you're so hot and so on and so forth, here's the job, let's see you do it. I mean, they were challenged and co-opted into the system. And many of them did very well.
I've read from several sources that between the 70s and maybe earlier, that the CIA and the State Department depended to some extent upon the Savak for intelligence assessments of internal Iranian developments. Was that ever the case? Or how much was that
dependent, I think, is misleading. Certainly, we would get information from Savak on what was going on internally. I think that there was a good bit of what we got was received with a high degree of skepticism. We did not have, frankly, a very high confidence in Sabak's abilities to deal with either the internal or external security threat, in the sense security threat in terms of subversion and agents and so forth. They did uncover a few, a couple of Soviet-sponsored, Soviet spies. but the overall, and again, this is sort of the myth versus reality. The myth was the sort of this omnipotent organization that knew every detail of everybody's life, every Iranian's life at home and abroad, and sort of the master organization. Well, that was about as far from the truth as you could possibly get. They basically were Keystone Cops.
Okay. I read that about 1972, one Iran expert, the CIA, named Jesse Leaf.
What's his name?
Jesse Leaf, L-E-A-F.
L-E-A-F.
This is another article in the New York Times I saw about this. I guess he wrote a draft of a report suggesting that by ignoring social and economic needs at home, the Shah was sowing the seeds for popular discontent. Were there any CIA assessments along those lines, or drafts of assessments that might have been provoked some discussion?
There was debate, and a quite vigorous debate, about these kinds of questions. I don't remember that particular fellow, but this went on, again, sort of on a continuing basis. This was nothing particularly new. And I think that it was generally a generally accepted view that he ought to be paying more attention to some of these questions. Not necessarily that this was an imminent danger, but if one took the longer view, that he was going to have to do this at some stage, and better if he could begin to address these questions early on, so that the destruction that they inevitably would cause would be mitigated to a certain degree.
It's been alleged in a couple places I've read that at some point, it's not clear when, the CIA phased out its agent, much of its agent network in Iran, in exchange for the right to have stations from which it could monitor Soviet missile tests. Some kind of agreement, formal or otherwise, made with the Shah about this. What is that?
I don't.
Sound familiar?
No, I don't. I mean, the question of the size of CIA presence in Iran, or indeed Iranian Sabak presence in the United States, I think had been discussed one stage or another. I don't ever recall that there was a sort of a quid pro quo in terms of we'll cut back the number of people we have in Iran if you provide us with these facilities here and there. At one point in my, as country director in Washington, I would not necessarily have been involved in that. And as the DCM in Tehran, the question didn't arise that I can recall. So I'm saying something may have happened prior to my having been in Iran. Again, I don't think on a quid pro quo basis, but I can vaguely recall that there was some discussion of how many people were there. But this was this was more or as much a discussion internally within the United States government. We were constantly fighting the battle of numbers, and that there were, you know, too damn many Americans running around doing too damn many things that may have included CIA, and that we just had to keep this under control as best we could. It was a constant struggle. And I was very active and very firm about identifying, to the extent we could, unnecessary activities and just cutting them out. I mean, God, we had the geographic survey people there that had been there 20 years. I said, you know, what the hell are you guys doing here? I finally got our Armed Forces radio network people to pack up and go home. And, you know, things like, well, they were just...
lots of programs. Yeah. Now, during the 70s, Iranian critics of the Shah were fairly active in the United States, in various cities.
Right.
Did these activities have any diplomatic repercussions, particularly?
Yeah. The Iranians, I don't recall the Shah personally, but certainly his prime minister and foreign minister and deputy foreign minister and so forth, would periodically give us a blast about the activity, one or another egregious behavior of some Iranian dissident in the United States. I got a lot of heat on that, personally.
Who was the ambassador at this time? Was the ambassador Ansari at this time, or was it Tom?
Shang Ansari was ambassador. No, Zahidi came back. When did Ardashir came back as ambassador in 69? Not 69. I beg your pardon. Maybe that was Aslan Afshar. He was ambassador when I was there most of that time, if not all of that time. Precise date. Ansari was ambassador. I remember Agnew was vice president because they used to play poker together.
Poker?
Then Aslan Afshar came. Very nice man. A man who had been then after Aslan, sorry, I can't remember the chronology now.
Did they have any special influence back in Tehran? Were these influential people in their own right, or?
Ansari had some influence and made some impact. Aslan. He was from an old, wealthy, distinguished family back in Iran history. So he had a certain amount of independence, but he wasn't a political force or anything like that. He was just, you know, this distinguished man from a distinguished family who had been in the service of the imperial court for years. He or his family. But impact on policy, no, again, as I say, 90 to 95% of our really serious substantive work was conducted through our embassy.
Now, in July 7th, summer of 73, the Shah made another visit to Washington.
When's this?
Summer of 73, a few months before the price explosion in the fall. Do you think about that visit in particular, or is it just sort of escape? Yeah.
I don't recall a visit by him at all.
Yeah.
73?
July, I think. I think July. Yeah. So,
because
talking to James Hutchinson, he remembered the meeting with the Shah and talking about his concerns about about arms sales and so forth.
Why do I draw a blank? I was around. I think this is when Ardashir was in fact when he was ambassador. Yeah. And right, okay. Now what was the question about Hector?
I remember reading the New York Times of that period, there was some discussion. They suggested there were discussions in the meetings of guarantees of the stability of petroleum supplies from Iran, things like that. Do you recall that was discussed? Whether they were concerned about the security of supplies coming from the Persian Gulf?
I can only answer yes. I remember that this was a question, and it must have been discussed.
Yeah.
Again, it was one of those sort of ongoing kinds of questions. But I can't recall any detail.
Okay. The following months, of course, I think October, November, oil prices increased dramatically. Were there any efforts by the State Department to try to get the Shah to take a less hawkish approach, take a less hawkish role in OPEC? How are these pressures handled?
Yes, there were a lot of efforts put into getting, not only Iran, but other members of OPEC to moderate their position. I'm sorry to say that we would be given very specious economic arguments to make to the Iranians on these points, which were so bad that I was embarrassed to even follow my instructions, because it was assumed that the Iranians didn't know anything about economics or the international oil market. And that was implicit in the kinds of things we were being asked to tell them, as if they were a bunch of morons. And we were talking to PhDs from Harvard or MBAs from Wharton. And so, they could just shoot holes, as they did, in many of the so-called arguments that we were asked to make.
What were the arguments that you were asked to make? What was the thrust of them, I guess?
The thrust of it was that this was inflationary. Gosh, I can't even remember. They were so dumb. I mean, one didn't really want to remember. I mean, they just weren't good economic arguments. Also, I remember one of the things that Shah would say, why shouldn't I? I mean, the market is this and so on and so forth. And furthermore, you are charging, the price on whatever I'm getting from you has gone up 500% here, and he's like chapter and verse, particularly in the military field. What the hell are you complaining about, in effect? You're doing just fine. You're getting all this back from us, for one thing, one way or another. But anyhow, yeah, there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and gnashing of teeth in the U.S. government, and a lot of we were being asked to make numerous representations and so forth. And as I say, by and large, the arguments were specious, or certainly could be there was another side to the discussion, and given the international situation at the time, so in the international oil market situation, what are you going to do?
Now, around the turn of the year, early 74, I guess Secretary of Treasury Simon suggested that the U.S. use the arms sales as leverage to get the Shah to help roll back prices.
Mm-hmm.
Was this discussed? Was this discussed in the State Department before he made this proposal, or was it, did you do it independently? Do you recall?
Anything I recall about Simon, I don't know that he. I don't know that this was an argument made to the Shah.
I think he made it in a public speech.
Or may have made it in a speech.
Yeah,
I don't.
Yeah.
I don't believe that it was ever accepted U.S. government policy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it was a proposal on his part.
I think it was a proposal on his part. I do vividly recall his saying the Shah was a nut or something like that, and my having to go in and sort of explain that when I didn't really mean he was a nut.
He had to tell us to the ambassador?
Huh?
He had to tell us to the ambassador? Or?
No, I was in Tehran at the time. I had to tell the Shah, I told Alam, who was Minister of Court, who fortunately was a good friend, but I that was not one of the easier jobs that I had to take on in my life. The Shah was goddamn good well inside, so he didn't like it at all. You know, he wouldn't talk about it, something like that. The head of state of a friendly ally.
Now, can you see, did the oil corporations make representations to the State Department to try to get, did they put much pressure on the State Department on these pricing questions, on open questions? To get the State Department to move in some way?
I don't recall it. Certainly there was, you know, a certain amount of exchange, but the person to talk to about that is Jim Akins. Jim was in charge of, I get the exact name of the office within the Bureau of Economic Affairs.
Energy Policy or something like that.
Energy Policy, yeah.
He was, at that point, he was in charge of around 73 or so.
About that time, yeah. Yeah.
No, I guess in March 74, the spring of 74, you became deputy chief of mission,
right,
at the embassy in Tehran.
Mm-hmm.
How did this come about? This
May 18th. Well, Dick Helms asked for me.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I was very pleased. Well, it was simple as that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, as DCM, what were your responsibilities? Your basic responsibilities? No, I'm not sure.
Is
it difficult to generalize that?
Well, in the DCM is, and this DCM and what he does is sort of like the vice president. What does the vice president do? It's the ambassador sort of defines what he's going to do. And obviously, there's a certain amount of direction as far as the DCM is concerned. But in terms of, say, government-to-government contact relations, the ambassador will, depending on his own bent and background and experience and so forth, may carve out certain spheres. Maybe he's interested, like Bill Sullivan. Bill was very interested in the military side. So, when Bill was there, when he came, and I was still there for a while, Bill spent more time on the military side of things than Dick had before. So I consequently spent less time on that. But the DCM is first the ambassador's alter ego. So the ambassador's not there, he's the acting ambassador. So he has to know what's going on right across the board. And to a greater, lesser degree, again, depending on the ambassador's own predilections, be involved in all of these things. And we have so many activities at that time in Iran, so many things going on vis-a-vis the Iran agenda. We were deeply in the field of atomic energy, which was an area that I became quite deeply involved in myself, in terms of negotiating with the Iranians on fuel supply, and the reprocessing question, and so on and so on and so forth. Well, it's just so difficult to we just literally had hundreds of things, and as I told you, the size of the mission was 2,500 people, that it was enough just to keep abreast, you might say. My basic function was, I suppose, being sure that everybody was sort of marching to the same tune, that there weren't any egregious departures, that if contact with government was necessary, it was the appropriate person at the appropriate level that was doing it, that we certainly didn't want the or need the narcotics attaché running around trying to talk to everybody in the government. If there was a particular issue, why he would talk to me about what would be the person to deal with, and whether it needed to be escalated and so forth. And this is just a tiny little example, but it was that kind of thing that went on all the time. I also, of course, paid very careful attention to what was being produced in the way of communication going back to Washington, the substance of what went out of the embassy. This was particularly true with the substantive reporting, telegrams as well as dispatches from the economic section and the political section. It dealt with oil questions, it dealt with political developments, it dealt with economic developments, etc. There is a significant element of representation involved, not only vis-a-vis the Iranian government, but just the Iranian society generally. So there's a certain amount of ribbon cutting, appearing here, and doing that kind of thing.
Okay. You were appointed Minister Counselor sometime in those years. Was that the same post, DCM Minister Counselor?
That's correct. The Deputy Chief of Mission is an operational title. Minister Counselor is the diplomatic title. It's the same thing.
Okay, I wasn't sure what the distinction.
Now, there is a distinction. Actually, it's Minister. You have Minister Counselors of Economic Affairs or Counselors of Economic Affairs, depending on size of the embassy generally and the importance. But the usual progression is ambassador, deputy chief of minister, minister counselor, same guy, same person. Then economic counselor, political counselor, public affairs counselor, administrative counselor, so forth.
Now, Helms is ambassador at this point. How did he approach his job as ambassador? How did Richard Helms approach his job as ambassador?
What do you mean?
I'll rephrase it. How would you assess him as ambassador?
He's very effective, knowledgeable. First, of course, we know what his background was. He had known the Shah over the years, and contacts with him. For example, it was traditional for when the Shah made a state visit to the United States, that there would be a private meeting with the director of CIA and the victims placed in that position. So he was he again didn't have to learn everything from ground zero when he arrived there. But by the time I arrived, he'd already been there, what, a year and a half or 2 years, almost, if I recall correctly. So he was well into the job and well acquainted throughout the government, the Iranian government apparatus, as well as just society generally.